Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Monday, April 4th, 2022. Senate Judiciary Committee deadlocking on Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to be Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. All 11 Democrats voting yes, all 11 Republicans voting no. And that means the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer will be making an additional step, a motion to discharge to get the nomination to the Senate floor. Still, all indications are that a vote to confirm Judge Jackson will take place by the end of the week, and it will pass, meaning she'll become a member of the Supreme Court. President Joe Biden calling for Russian President Vladimir Putin to be put on trial for war crimes following the reports the Russian military killed hundreds of civilians in a town just outside the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv. And three U.S. Republican state attorneys general suing the Biden administration over plans to repeal Title 42. That's the law that's been used by both former President Donald Trump and current President Joe Biden to expel migrants coming across the U.S.-Mexico border on the grounds of preventing the further spread of COVID-19. Now to the Senate Judiciary Committee meeting today for a final discussion and vote on Supreme Court nominee Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. Head of the vote, each senator given an opportunity to speak. Senator Cory Booker, Democrat from New Jersey, the only African-American on the committee, talking about the nominee making history, being the first black woman nominated. And he also talked about the way Republican senators asked the nominee questions during the hearing a week and a half ago.
I am hearing from people, not just black women, but particularly black women, who have been relating to me their stories about having to come into a room where you're more qualified than the people who are sitting in judgment of you and having to endure the absurdities of disrespect that we saw Judge Jackson endure. The stories I'm hearing are replete from folks in all kind of jobs and all kind of experiences in their lives who are so qualified, so worthy, and what they've had to endure. And that's what struck a chord this week. I don't think, again, we are going to have our political substantive disagreements, but it was the treatment in some of these questions that triggered a hurt in so many people I know and have encountered. How could they create these caricatures? How could they create these exaggerations? How could they disrespect a person like her who's done everything right in her life and in her journey? How? How qualified do you have to be, double Harvard? How qualified do you have to be clerking at all levels of the federal judiciary? How qualified do you have to be three times confirmed by the Senate in a bipartisan manner? And so, Senate, I have to say, today is the birthday of a great poet named Maya Angelou. And so I'm just gonna end with those words. Why does this poem strike a chord with so many Americans? Because they feel it to their bones. And so this is in honor of Maya Angelou and the next Supreme Court Justice of the United States of America. Happy birthday, Maya, Dr. Angelou. You may try to write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me down in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I rise. Rise, Sister Jackson. Rise, Judge Jackson, all the way to the highest court in the land. And when we have that final vote, I will rejoice. Ancestors will rejoice. And we will say, Lord, this is a day that you have made.
Senator Cory Booker, Democrat from New Jersey, today's Judiciary Committee meeting, part of his statement announcing he'd be voting yes on the Supreme Court nomination. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina said he would be voting no. Graham said that Ketanji Brown Jackson is the first black woman to be nominated to the Supreme Court, but it might have been Judge Janice Rogers Brown in 2005, nominated by a Republican president, George W. Bush, had Democrats not indicated they'd be opposing her that year. Senator Graham also warning if Republicans control the Senate after this November's elections, it's possible some of Democratic President Joe Biden's nominees might not get a hearing.
When you had a chance to support an African-American conservative, you used her ideology against her. You blocked her from being considered by this committee. And we're supposed to be like trained seals over here clapping when you appoint a liberal. That's not going to work. We live in America today where your ideology is held against you if you're a conservative, and when you're a liberal, we're supposed to embrace everything about you and not ask hard questions. That's not the world we're going to live in. And I'll say this, if we get back the Senate and we're in charge of this body, and there's judicial openings, we will talk to our colleagues on the other side. But if we're in charge, she would not have been before this committee. You would have had somebody more moderate than this. So I want you to know right now, the process you started to go to a simple majority vote is going to rear its head here pretty soon. Where we're in charge, then we'll talk about judges differently.
Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican from South Carolina, Senate Judiciary Committee meeting today. Politico writes that the fate of the panel's vote tally, which was 11-11 party line, was all but sealed after Senators Tom Tillis, Republican of North Carolina, and Ben Sasse, Republican from Nebraska, announced that they would vote against Jackson ahead of the hearing. Democrats had privately hoped those two senators would consider supporting Jackson or abstaining, given their comparatively friendly style of questioning during her confirmation hearing. That from Politico. One of the issues that came up consistently on the Republican side during the questioning was sentencing guidelines for criminals. And Senator Josh Hawley, Republican from Missouri today, bringing it up in his statement, indicating he'd be voting no on the nominee.
I enjoyed the opportunity to meet with Judge Jackson in person several weeks ago. I found our exchanges here on the committee after almost an hour of questioning to be very substantive and very thorough. And based on the answers that I heard from her then and in response to my other colleagues, I can say definitively that I like her. I think she's a good person, but I cannot support her. And I want to say a word or two as to why. We heard from her. She told me this actually when we sat down together in our meeting, and she said it again under oath, that she has no particular judicial philosophy. She's said in response to questions that she has no view on whether or not people have natural rights. Curious. She told Senator Blackburn she can't define what a woman is, but the one thing that she seemed to be very comfortable saying quite definitively is that she thinks the U.S. federal sentencing guidelines for criminals are too harsh. She said it repeatedly here under oath. We've talked about it at length. Her record reflects it. And I just want to say that I agree with my Democrat colleagues on this point, at least. When it comes to a judicial philosophy, it probably is true that the best way to ascertain a nominee's judicial philosophy is to look at their record. And for days, that is exactly what we have done. I sat with the nominee and went through 55 pages of transcripts in her cases. We talked about multiple cases, other senators questioned her on this score as well, and when you look at her record in depth, her consistent policy position is that the federal sentencing guidelines are outdated, they are outmoded, they are too harsh, and that criminals in general are over-sentenced. And I just have to say, I couldn't disagree with her more.
Senator Josh Hawley, Republican from Missouri. Pushing back on that notion that Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson is soft on crime, Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat from Minnesota, from today's Judiciary Committee meeting.
Throughout the hearing, Judge Jackson demonstrated her command of the law and her reverence for the Constitution. Judge Jackson, in fact, as we know, has more judicial experience than four of the nominees and now justices had when they came before this committee. Four people who are currently serving on the court. She'll be the first person on the court to be in the room where it happens, where those decisions are made, with public defender experience. She knows the importance of public service from her parents, both teachers, and she has that perspective of knowing that life isn't always easy. She's had family members who served in law enforcement. And I think this might be a good moment to get at some of the arguments my colleagues have and will be making. And I think I might be a good person to bring this up because I'm someone that has consistently asked questions of nominees. I always ask about antitrust, even though they don't want me to ask it. I always ask about the First Amendment and some many detailed questions about stare decisis and the like. And I was the one on this committee that one of the nominees actually apologized to. Not for what I did, but what he said. And I want to get at some of the criticisms that we have heard lodged against this great woman. when we hear about this child pornography, what I see a mom who opened up her heart to all of us and explained to all of us how no one can be the perfect mom, no matter how hard you try. I see a woman of deep faith who was questioned about that and explained her deep faith many, many times. Let's look at the facts. In 8 of the 11 child pornography cases that Judge Jackson handled, she gave a sentence at or above either the probation office recommendations. And when she imposed other sentences, it was because she looked at the case carefully. And by the way, she made her own decision. Maybe not everyone in this room would have agreed with it, but she was being a judge. Just like judges that were supported by my colleagues made that decision. I'm not even going to mention these judges' names that I'm about to talk about, because I don't think they should be dragged into this just because they happened to make decisions that were below guidelines.
Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat from Minnesota. After about 3.5 hours of statements from the senators on the Judiciary Committee, all had spoken except one, Alex Padilla, Democrat of California. The committee chair, Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, explaining that Senator Padilla and his family had planned to take the red-eye commercial air flight overnight from California, but a medical emergency on board, not the senator or his family, forced the plane to return to Los Angeles, and he couldn't get another flight until today. So the committee had to recess for a couple of hours, returning late afternoon Monday with Senator Padilla in attendance, and then the chair, Dick Durbin, making a statement and calling for the final vote.
Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. I'd like to acknowledge first that I said a word earlier about senators pairing in a thoughtful way to help one another, and I mentioned Senator Coons and Senator Isaacson, and I didn't mention Senator Cornyn and Senator Feinstein. And I want to acknowledge that this is bipartisan generosity and acknowledge your kind effort as well. I also want to welcome Senator Alex Padilla. We're glad you made it. I know it was a harrowing journey starting late last night, and we're glad you're here. So if there are no further comments on favorably reporting the nomination of Ketanji Brown Jackson to be Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States, the clerk will call the roll.
Mr. Leahy.
Aye.
Mrs. Feinstein.
Aye.
Mr. Whitehouse.
Aye.
Ms. Klobuchar.
Aye.
Mr. Coons.
Aye.
Mr. Blumenthal.
Aye.
Ms. Hirono.
Aye.
Mr. Booker.
Aye.
Mr. Padilla.
Aye.
Mr. Ossoff.
Aye.
Mr. Grassley.
No.
Mr. Graham.
No.
Mr. Cornyn.
No.
Mr. Lee.
No.
Mr. Cruz.
No.
Mr. Sass.
No.
Mr. Hawley.
No.
Mr. Cotton.
No.
Mr. Kennedy.
No.
Mr. Tillis.
No.
Mrs. Blackburn.
No.
Mr. Chair Durbin.
Aye.
Chair Durbin, the votes are 11 yeas, 11 nays. It's a tie vote.
The committee has recorded a tie vote on Judge Jackson's nomination to be the Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. Pursuant to Section 3, Subsection 1A of Senate Resolution 27 of the 117th Congress, I'll transmit to the Secretary of the Senate a notice of this tie vote.
That's Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, chair of the Judiciary Committee. So 11 yes and 11 no, party line. The vote fails. First time that's happened in a Supreme Court nomination since 1991 when Clarence Thomas was the nominee. But in that case, and by the way, current President Joe Biden was chair of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate at the time, in that case, the committee voted separately to report the nomination to the full Senate without recommendation. That did not happen this time. So Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer came to the floor to take an extra procedural step, a motion to discharge the nominee from committee that requires a simple majority vote of the 100 members. And if that's successful, then they move on to actually considering the nominee. Again, majority vote needed to confirm. It's expected by the end of the week. AP notes it's expected that all 50 Democrats in the Senate will support Judge Jackson, though one notable moderate Democrat, Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema, hasn't yet said how she will vote. One Republican so far says she'll be voting yes, Susan Collins of May. Follow it all on the C-SPAN networks. Three Republican state attorneys general suing the Biden administration over its plans to rescind Title 42. That's the public health regulation that allows the quick expulsion of immigrants crossing over the U.S.-Mexico border seeking asylum. Former President Donald Trump implemented it using the justification of the COVID-19 pandemic, and it was continued for a time by current President Joe Biden. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announcing last week that it plans to repeal it by May 23rd. One of the attorneys general suing, Mark Brnovich of Arizona, interviewed today on Fox News.
We are filing another lawsuit against the Biden administration, and basically we know that their attempt to rescind Title 42 will lead to drastic consequences on our southern border. And right now it's essentially on fire, and this is, will be like throwing gasoline on a fire. So we want to stop the Biden administration from rescinding Title 42 because it may be one of the most boneheaded decisions of this administration, and they have done a lot of dumb things.
But you will have to find a federal judge who agrees with you, yes. And then I'm sure the White House yes. will appeal. What are the chances that you'll be successful?
Well, I just argued just a little over a month ago against the Biden administration in court when they rescinded the public charge rule, and I'm confident we'll win that case, and I'm confident we'll win this case, because literally, if the Biden administration rescinds this policy, it will result in more than 500,000 people, it's estimated, to illegally cross our border in just 1 month. That's like the entire population of Baltimore, Atlanta, Georgia. So the system is already being overwhelmed. The cartels have seized control of the border. We see a record amount of fentanyl coming into this country, and now you're going to throw on top of that hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people just stretching thin our social and safety network and endangering our community. So, Ainsley, I'm doing everything I can to hold the Biden administration accountable and stop them from destroying our southern border.
Arizona Attorney General Mark Brnovich, a Republican, he's also a U.S. Senate candidate on Fox News Channel today. He's joined by Louisiana and Missouri in this lawsuit against the Biden administration, claiming that Title 42, that the repeal of it violates a law that requires a public comment period. Some reaction from the White House, Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
So one question on Title 42, some Republican attorneys general are suing the administration over the plan to lift it. What is the administration's response and administration concerns this would end up blocking the push to lift the order?
Well, on the lawsuit itself, I'd, of course, refer you to the Department of Justice. They would be overseeing any steps there. But broadly speaking, I think it's important to note for any critics and any lawsuits that Title 42 is a public health directive. It's not an immigration, migration, enforcement measure. And the decision on when to lift Title 42 was made by the CDC. And our objective firm here, and this is why we have the implementation period over the next several weeks, continues to be to ensure we are increasing our resources, surging personnel and resources to the border, improving border processing, implementing COVID-19 mitigation measures, and continuing to work with other countries in the Western Hemisphere to manage migration and address root causes. But this is, again, a healthcare measure, a health measure determination, and not one, not an immigration policy.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki with reporters in the White House briefing room. Over half of the more than 160,000 immigrants encountered at the U.S.-Mexico border in February were expelled under the Title 42 public health order. And the Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas saying on Friday, which was the day the CDC announced that it would be repealed in May, he said his department has put in place a comprehensive whole-of-government strategy to manage any potential increase in the number of migrants encountered at our border. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. From USA Today, President Joe Biden on Monday called for a war crimes trial against Russian President Vladimir Putin and more sanctions against Russia following new reports of atrocities in Ukraine after Russian troops retreated from areas around Kyiv. Biden joined a growing chorus of world leaders on Monday who condemned Russia after Ukrainian officials said the bodies of 410 civilians were found in Kyiv-area towns that were recently retaken from Russian forces. In Bucha, 280 people were buried in mass graves, according to an advisor to the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who visited the city on Monday. President Biden speaking with reporters at Fort McNair, returning to the Washington area from Delaware.
To make before I start the day. You may remember I got criticized for calling
Putin a war criminal. Well, the truth of the matter, you saw what happened in Vukovar. This warrants him. He is a war criminal. But we have to gather the information. We have to continue to provide Ukraine with the weapons they need to continue the fight. And we have to gather all the detail so this can be an actual, have a war crime trial. This guy is brutal. And what's happening in Bucha is outrageous. And everyone's seen it.
Up to Allah. Genocide?
No, I think it is a war crime.
Are you going to do more sanctions on Russia?
I'm seeking more sanctions, yes. I'll have time to announce that to you.
Can you hold him accountable, though, you called him a war criminal?
He should be held accountable.
Can you hold him accountable
without sanctions?
Well, no. What else can you do?
No, no, go the war crimes up. Yes, I'm going to continue to add sanctions. Thank you. I'll let you know.
President Biden with reporters. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, when he visited Bucha, that town just outside of Kyiv, did use the word genocide describing Russia's actions. CNN reports that Zelensky told reporters there the atrocities carried out in the town Bucha typify the nature of the Russian military, and that they treat people worse than animals. In the White House briefing room, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan getting follow-up questions to President Biden's statement.
Jake, can I ask you about the president's call for a war crimes trial for Vladimir Putin? What are the mechanics of how the president sees that playing out? Would it be at the International Criminal Court or in some other tribunal?
So we have to consult with our allies and partners on what makes most sense as a mechanism moving forward. Obviously, the ICC is one venue where war crimes have been tried in the past, but there have been other examples in other conflicts of other mechanisms being set up. So there's work to be done to work out the specifics of that. And between now and then, every day, what we are focused on is continuing to apply pressure to the Russian economy and provide weapons to the Ukrainian people to be able to defend themselves.
Other forums for this might include something that the UN Security Council might adopt. Is that what you're suggesting, that you would go to the Security Council?
Well, obviously, with Russia as a permanent member of the UN Security Council, it would be difficult to imagine that they would not attempt to exercise their veto to block something. But there have been creative solutions to the question of accountability in the past, and I'm not going to prejudge what solution would be applied here or what forum or venue would be applied here. What I will say is what the president said this morning. There has to be accountability for these war crimes. That accountability has to be felt at every level of the Russian system, and the United States will work with the international community to ensure that accountability is applied at the appropriate time. Yes.
The president was careful to say he does not see this as genocide. Many Ukrainians believe that it is because their nation, their people are being attacked. Where is the line in your view, and how have you counseled the president between genocide and war crimes?
So this is something we, of course, continue to monitor every day. Based on what we have seen so far, we have seen atrocities, we have seen war crimes, we have not yet seen a level of systematic deprivation of life of the Ukrainian people to rise to the level of genocide. But again, that's something we will continue to monitor. There is not a mechanical formula for this. There is a process that we have run just recently at the State Department to ultimately determine that the killing, the mass killing of Rohingya in Burma constituted genocide. That was a lengthy process based on an amassing of evidence over a considerable period of time and involving, frankly, mass death, the mass incarceration of a significant portion of the Rohingya population. And we will look to a series of indicators along those lines to ultimately make a determination in Ukraine. But as the president said today, we have not arrived at that conclusion yet.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. From Associated Press, the bodies of 410 civilians have been removed from Kyiv area towns that were recently retaken by Russian forces. The Ukrainian prosecutor general telling the Associated Press. And AP journalists write they saw the bodies of at least 21 people in various spots around Bucha, northwest of the capital. Russia is saying all this is not true. The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov speaking in Moscow, meeting with the UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs.
Recently, another fake attack was carried out in the city of Bucha in the Kyiv region after the Russian servicemen left the area in accordance with the agreements reached. A fake attack was staged there a few days later, and it's being fomented on all channels and social media by Ukrainian representatives and their Western patrons. The Russian armed forces completely withdrew from Bucha on March 30th. On March 31st, the mayor solemnly said he had everything in order. And 2 days later, we saw the staging organized in the streets. They're now trying to leverage that for anti-Russian purposes.
The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov today in Moscow. U.S. Ambassador to the UN Linda Thomas-Greenfield tweeting today, in close coordination with Ukraine, European countries, and other partners of the UN, we are going to seek Russia's suspension from the UN Human Rights Council. She went on, Russia's participation on the Human Rights Council is a farce. It hurts the credibility of the Council and the UN writ large, and it is wrong, which is why we believe it is time the UN General Assembly vote to suspend them. It would take a two-thirds majority vote of the United Nations General Assembly to suspend Russia's membership. That's of 193 members. European Union today announcing it has established a joint investigation with Ukraine to look into the alleged Russian war crimes and crimes against humanity. The EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen offering Ukrainian President Zelensky her condolence on what she calls the dreadful murders that were revealed over the weekend and what she describes as harrowing images. The Russian forces pulling back from Kyiv and other areas believed to be part of a larger redeployment of its forces. More on this from today's Pentagon briefing with the press secretary, John Kirby.
We do believe that that the Russian military intends to focus their efforts on the Donbas area and the east. We do believe that as they move forces out of Kyiv and Chernihiv and places like Sumy, that they are going to put these units into a refit regimen so that they can be resupplied, maybe even reinforced with manpower, and then applied elsewhere into the country. We think that the most likely place for them to be reapplied into the fight in Ukraine is in the east, in the Donbas. We have not seen wholesale movement in that regard. We're only just now seeing more movement of forces out of Ukraine and up into the north. But too soon to say that we can see any of those battalion tactical groups being actively resupplied and then reapplied into the fight. That hasn't really happened yet. That said, Lita, we have seen efforts by the Russian military to get more aggressive and go more on the offense in the Donbas. This is on the ground as they push south from that town called Izium and try to close off Ukrainian armed forces in the Donbas. As they now focus more of their airstrike activity on the Donbas area and the JFO, the Joint Forces Operations Area, as they now press the Wagner Group to add to their recruiting totals and then move those contractors into the Donbas. So we have seen more kinetic activity, more military operations, if you will, in the Donbas. So clearly they are definitely putting a priority on that part of Ukraine. We just haven't seen that. There's been, out of the forces that are repositioning out of Kyiv and Chernihiv, we haven't seen them be reintroduced back into the fight yet.
That's the Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby with reporters. U.S. government helping Spain to seize a yacht of a Russian oligarch. First such seizure after the pledge by President Biden to go after the elite's ill-begotten gains, as he put it. The 255-foot Tango is the property of Viktor Vesselberg, an ally of Russian President Vladimir Putin, who leads the Renova Group. It's a metal and mining conglomerate that yacht seized in Spain. Also, the Baltic states of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia becoming Europe's first region to not have any more Russian gas supplies imported into their countries entirely. Lithuania was the first EU nation to make the move, declaring on Saturday that the country was acting in response to Russia's energy blackmail in Europe, according to a news release from the country's energy ministry. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken welcoming former U.S. Secretary of State James Baker for an unveiling of a bronze bust of Baker at the State Department building in Washington, their National Museum of American Diplomacy. James Baker was secretary 1989 through 92 under President George H.W. Bush, and Blinken today praising Baker's handling of another difficult time in U.S.-Russia relations when the Soviet Union collapsed.
James Baker served as Secretary of State for 43 months. I think it's safe to say that there are a few times in history when the world has changed so profoundly, what you call, Jim, a whirlwind of history. Or, as you said, late one night in April 1991, to a young staffer by the name of Bill Burns, sitting in a rundown hotel in the Caucasus. Have you ever seen so many things changing so damn fast? During that period, the Soviet Union disintegrated without conflict. The Berlin Wall fell. The US and the USSR undertook the most significant reduction ever in nuclear arms. Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait was swiftly routed. The Madrid Conference made visible for the first time a horizon of Middle East peace. We were talking about this just a short while ago. It's easy looking back at hinge moments in history to view these seismic shifts as somehow inevitable, particularly when the world moves from conflict and toward peace, away from autocracy and toward democracy. But to study those 43 months is to learn that these outcomes were anything but certain. The arc of history bent the way it did because people bent it, and no one more so than Secretary Baker. Like on November 9th, 1989, when Secretary Baker was hosting a luncheon upstairs in the Ben Franklin Room for President Aquino of the Philippines, he was handed a folded note informing him that the Berlin Wall was coming down. As he rushed over to the White House, he scribbled notes that read, "Something we've wanted for 40 years. Europe that's whole and free. Reunification on the basis of Western values." Now, that last part was very uncertain. Secretary Baker not only immediately saw where he wanted to end up, a democratic, reunited Germany, he cleared the path to get there. He staked out the principles that Germans, not outside powers, should get to determine their own future, and that Germany should be reunited within NATO, and then methodically brought our allies and the Soviets around to these positions. President George H.W. Bush, your doubles partner on the Houston tennis courts and professional partner in so much of life, summed up your leadership best. The president said, "He acted while others were still struggling to comprehend, and he got things done."
Secretary of State Antony Blinken honoring former Secretary of State James Baker. An unveiling of a bronze bust of Baker. Baker made some remarks talking about the current war between Russia and Ukraine and diplomatic response by the U.S. and other countries.
Ladies and gentlemen, I don't think there's been a moment in recent history when effective diplomacy has been needed any more than it's needed right now. And we were talking about this in the Secretary's office. We all know the winds of war are blowing hard in Ukraine, where citizens there are making some quite heroic efforts to maintain their independence. Protecting their freedoms while also making sure that the violence doesn't spread, that we don't trigger something else, is a really daunting task for the West. The West, led as usual by the United States. And I think this crisis once again proves the critical importance of American leadership. And I told the Secretary that I really support and agree with the steps that have been taken in facing up to this problem. I think they've done a masterful job. I think it's too soon to declare victory. Some people are inclined to declare victory now, some commentators. I think it's too soon for that. But the fact remains that the United States is and still will remain for some time a force for international peace and stability. And so, Mr. Secretary, I want you to know that you and our country have my full support, as you and the dedicated officers of this wonderful department continue to lead our country's diplomatic efforts during this challenging time. And it is a challenging time, and you're doing a splendid job.
James Baker was Secretary of State under President George H.W. Bush. Today at the State Department being honored. He's 91 years old, turns 92 later this month. James Baker was also a White House Chief of Staff for both Presidents George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan, and was a former Treasury Secretary under Ronald Reagan. Wall Street today, the Dow up 103, NASDAQ up 271, S&P up 36. Associated Press reporting that Senate bargainers have reached agreement on a slimmed-down $10 billion package for countering COVID-19, the top Democratic and Republican negotiators said Monday. But the measure dropped all funding to help nations abroad combat the pandemic. President Biden today highlighting steps to increase employment in the trucking industry to ease supply chain problems caused in part by the pandemic. President speaking outside the White House with a couple of 18-wheeler cabins behind him.
It's getting harder and harder to recruit new drivers, particularly women and people of color, to an industry that this nation and our economy desperately needs at full strength. The good news is that since I took office, we've begun to turn things around. In fact, in 2021 was the best year for trucking employment since 1994. There are now 35,000 more trucking jobs than there were before the pandemic. But we all know we need to move faster, getting more people working in this industry in jobs they can rely on and raise a family on. That's why last December, we brought together industry and labor to tackle the problem facing drivers. And we listened. And when we heard that there were long wait times in many states for people to get their commercial driver's license, or CDLs, we took action. We provided technical assistance as well as $57 million in federal funds to help states issue these CDLs faster. And I'm proud to report, because of Pete and others, so far in 2022, we're issuing CDLs at double the rate of last year, 120,000 in January and February alone. We also know that the key ingredient to getting and keeping more drivers was increasing training programs like the registered apprenticeships approved by the Department of Labor, programs that allow aspiring drivers to learn while earn while they learn, while making this essential job more attractive for potential drivers, regardless of age, background, and gender. The program has proven to be improved safety and better working conditions and better pay and benefits. Typically, it takes about 8 months to create a registered apprenticeship program. But because of Pete and others in the Department of Labor, we're able to cut the red tape, and now it takes as little as 2 days. As a result, in the last 90 days, 100 major employers have launched new registered apprenticeship programs. UPS, Domino's, Pepsi's, Albertsons, and more, along with the trade associations like the American Trucking Association, the National Minority Trucking Association, the Food Industry Association, and others. What that all adds up to is a strong foundation for the work ahead.
President Biden on the White House lawn, a couple of big rigs behind him, an event on the president's trucking action plan aimed at dealing with supply chain disruptions brought about by the COVID-19 pandemic. New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu, a Republican, roasted former President Donald Trump during a Gridiron Club dinner on Saturday. And according to various reports, it wasn't open to the public. He said of Donald Trump, he's effing crazy. He did use the full word. He said, the press often will ask me if I think Donald Trump is crazy, and I'll say it this way. I don't think he's so crazy. You could put him in a mental institution, but I think if he were in one, he ain't getting out. Well, that was on Saturday. This morning, Governor Sununu was on WGIR AM radio, the program New Hampshire Today, with Chris Ryan.
There's a dude, though, that we both know of that doesn't necessarily have the best sense of humor when people make fun of him. I don't know if you're aware of him. His name is Donald Trump, and he's currently down in Mar-a-Lago. And I'm curious, you know, have you heard from him? Have you heard from folks there?
No, it's a roast. Look, if anyone is taking any of those jokes seriously, then you lighten up. I mean, really, it's a roast. It's fun. Like I said, I made jokes about my own family and myself and Republicans as much as I made fun about Democrats and Joe Biden and AOC and Bernie Sanders and socialists. Everyone on each side make jokes about everybody. President Trump has been there. He knows what that's about. So, you know, it's lighthearted. Anyone in the press that is like overthinking this and taking it too seriously. Look, the last 2 years has been hard. It's been a very serious 2 years. Lighten up. It's a joke.
New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu on New Hampshire Today, program on WGIR Radio. Associated Press writes that the Gridiron Club's spring dinner, and this happened Saturday night at the dinner, is an annual Washington gathering featuring skits and speeches from Democrats, Republicans, and journalists that are expected to singe but not burn the Capitol's political elite. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Get more top Washington stories sent right to you each day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word. You can sign up at c-span.org/connect. Hope you have a good night.